while the middle distance and the far distance was a bit out of focus and we weren't sure where we were going, center focus in the portrait of God painted by the Jews is a very clear picture, and there's no doubts about it. And I'm going to spend half an hour removing any doubts you might ever have had, and there's just no room to move here. There's a perfectly clear picture on who God is. And every other image has to stand and fall in its relation to the image I'm about to present to you, which is the sacred central image of Judaism of who their God is. And so it happens that the prophets purify the middle distance images and gradually sort through the half-seen revelations that occur in those writings as they grow, looking through a glass darkly at the mystery of God. Until finally, when you come to the New Testament, as I hope to show you in the second part of tonight, there's only one image left. And it's not a new image, except that it is the face of Jesus. It's the same image that I'm about to show you. The key text is, as I have mentioned to you there, Exodus chapter 3. It's the burning bush. It's the God. If you ask any Jew who is God, they will all tell you he is the God of the Exodus. He's the God of the journey. He's the God, the Redeemer God, who took us out of Egypt and took us to the Promised Land. There's the key image. And in that text, when Moses is overwhelmed by the glory cloud and enters into the sacred in that desert place, having run from God, God, as it were, caught up with him. And the word came to him, demanding of him that he go back to Egypt and redeem my people. He asks the question that every Jew knows, that is at the heart of Jesus' religion: who are you? Who are you that I may tell the people who it is who sends me? And the answer God gives in the Hebrew, Eye Asher Eye. I am the God of your fathers, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Tell them that Yahweh sent you. And here's this four-letter word, Yahweh, no vowels in the Hebrew, and it's the tetragram, it's often called. And these four letters, unique in Hebrew language, Yahweh is the name they gave their God. Now that is translated in all kinds of ways, and I won't spend time with you because it's rather difficult. It doesn't occur anywhere else. And it's translated, I am who I am, or I am the one who is, or I am who I will be. I will be who I will be. It's uncertain, the actual meaning of that Eye Asher Eye. It may be I am who I am, meaning I am the mystery, you can't name me. It may be I am the one who is, as distinct from I am not those who aren't. Or it may be, and I think this is most likely, not a name at all, but a promise. I will be who I will be. God, when he answers that word to Moses and gives him not his name, but he says to Moses, look, if you remember, you'll find out who I am. I am the God of your fathers. If you go back and remember, I was there. I am the, and he could say that to any people, I am the God of your fathers. And he also says, I am the God of your future. Stay with me and you will find out who I am. I will be who I will be for you. It's a promise of fidelity, but we can't name God. And that Yahweh, that mysterious one, that mysterious presence, his first words are, go back into Egypt, for I am determined to redeem my people. As I said a moment ago, the essential image of that mysterious God, however ineffable, is he is the one who redeems. God redeems people primarily, of course, from Egypt. There's the initial image. But as they became more and more deeply aware of their own position, a theology developed right through the Old Testament, and it will continue into the New. God is the one who redeems ultimately from sin. Now, sin's a little tiny little word, and it's not a very obscure meaning to it. So let me try to spend a little bit of time with you on that subject. Because in talking about sin, we're talking about the real radical darkness that haunts us all. To appreciate what sin means in the Bible, I'd like to just paint a picture for you of something where there's no sin. You'll all recognize it immediately. imagine a lovely circle of light, and you're at the center of it. Or your little child is at the center. It's a circle of love. It's a home. It's a garden. It's a beautiful place. And in that beautiful place, you were conceived, the womb of your mother, the love of your parents, the family that surrounded you, perhaps. And as you were conceived there, you were loved there. You were loved into being and then nurtured in that love. And as a little child, speaking ideally now, you learnt in that center of love, you learnt to trust. You learnt to believe. And the word itself means to be in love, as you can probably tell by looking at it. B-E and L-I-E-F. You were in love, and being in love, you grew and you matured until gradually you had space for your little sister or little brother, and you didn't have that much space, so you had to be trained to have more and so on, and you grew into someone who could then become the circle for someone else. You became a lover who could make love, and others could be in that love. Neighbors, husband, wife, children, family, friends, people, the world, whatever. And that picture is a picture, perhaps, of the development of a human being in a totally beautiful world where there's no sin. But, in case you didn't know, I don't want to disappoint you or frighten you, but there's another thing that happens. We're surrounded by love, all right, to some extent, but we're also surrounded by non-love. We are surrounded by fidelity, but not always fidelity. Our human experience, everybody's human experience, is that sometimes you're not loved. Sometimes you're not, a person is not faithful to you. Sometimes, as a little child, you open your arms to be loved and you're hurt by a mother who can't cope anymore. I'm not introducing blame into any of this. Or by a father who can't cope, or by a teacher, or by whole processes of life that we'll just leave there for your imagining. And so you learn another thing when you're a little child. You learn to not trust. You learn to be afraid. You learn to fear, don't you? You learn not to believe. And so that is the source of an immaturity. It stops you maturing, it stops you opening, it stops you being able to love, and in fact it means that now as an adult your ability to make love is severely limited, and our abilities vary according to millions of factors that we can hardly imagine and certainly can't define. But we all are aware of the fact that our ability to create love has limits to it, and we fail, and we in turn fail to love and fail to be faithful. That failure, that non-loving, is what's called in the Bible sin. The Greek word is hamartia, which means missing the mark. It means being bushed, literally. You're going along a track and then you get off the track and you don't know where you are. So you're going through a marriage and you get into rough things, and someone falls overboard and you find out it was your husband or your wife, and you don't know where you are, and the sails are drooping and there's no wind and something, and a storm brews or whatever. So you're bushed, or you're in your priesthood, you don't know where you're going, and after a while you don't give a damn where you're going anyhow, because no one seems to care, or whatever, or religious life, or any just human existence. You're bushed, you're off the track, you're lost, you're alienated, you're out of touch, or you're in touch with something, but you seem to be out of touch with your environment, and in general you're lost. You're Now the Bible would say you are in sin. And leave it. I haven't used the word guilt, don't intend to. That's a secondary question. The primary thing is that experience of the human of being anything less than faithful and anything less than loving. God is drawing all of us to himself, so people believe. And God draws us, the way to God is into the very heart of our existence, where we believe God loves us. And yet, through all this experience, because partly we're just being human, partly we're just born into it, the fact that I'm alive, the fact that I am my parents' child through my heredity, and not only that, I'm distracted by my environment because of other people's sin surrounding me, I end up walking strange paths and being lost. And it's no fault of my own, and we'd sometimes call it original sin, to get a big word to cope with all that mystery. And sometimes another tragic thing happens to us, and we call it personal sin, when I actually add to the dark, when I could walk on the track but I choose to walk off it, when I could love and I don't. And that's the profound mystery. Mostly I don't love because I can't, and I don't know why. But there are times when I could and don't. And therefore I just add a little bit more dark to the darkness surrounding others. The simple point I'm trying to make to you is the Jewish people believed that Yahweh, the Redeemer, God, was the one who redeemed us from this. That Yahweh was the creator of light. He made all things good. And whatever this mysterious thing that's called evil is, or personal sin, or darkness, or infidelity, they somehow sensed that it wasn't from God, that it was from our sin, our abuse of freedom. And I don't intend going into this subject tonight. We'll do a whole subject evening on it later in the course. But they looked to God to be the one who would redeem them from it. And when they looked to God to give meaning to their lives, to take them along the Torah, the way of instruction, the law, that if they followed this Torah, this way that God showed them on Mount Sinai, they would learn to love and they would gradually become holy. They looked at this God as a God of, I have two words there for you, Chesed ve'emet is the Hebrew, and they often call God simply Chesed ve'emet. And this is their central image. It means, chesed means covenant love, promised love, like a marriage love or a love of father to child, mother to child. It's a covenant that God has made with us. And emet means faithful, that he is the faithful one. That this God, in bringing us firstly into creation, has promised us life and will not let that promise go. God has promised Abraham, I will make your children as many as the stars of heaven, and that promise God will keep. And they clung to that covenant with God because their God was a redeemer and he would redeem them. So they believed. Finally, concluding my picture of God, the God of the Jewish people, the only theology they understood is liberation theology. The only theology that makes sense still is liberation theology. God is the liberator, the redeemer. And let me read to you just a few texts that bear this out. Exodus chapter 34, verse 6. They keep coming back to this image again and again. He called on the name of Yahweh. This is Moses. And Yahweh passed before him and proclaimed, Yahweh, Yahweh, a God of tenderness and compassion, slow to anger, rich in chesed ve'emet. Here it's translated kindness and faithfulness. Deuteronomy 10:18 is Moses saying to the people, look, you were slaves once in Egypt, and God redeemed you, so you must redeem others. And he, in his last will and testament, begging the people to be instruments of a Redeemer God in redeeming other people. Psalm 82 is quite an extraordinary psalm, where the psalmist envisaged all the gods. It's like the Olympian gods on the mountain, and they all come together, and then God, Yahweh, stands up in the midst of all the people, of all the other gods, as it were, and he's the one, let me just read it to you. God stands in the divine assembly. Among the gods, he, Yahweh, dispenses justice. No more mockery of justice, no more favoring the wicked. Let the weak and the orphan have justice, be fair to the wretched and destitute. Rescue the weak and needy, save them from the clutches of the wicked. Their God is the Redeemer God. And finally, though I could give you hundreds of texts if we had time, let me conclude by reading to you from Isaiah chapter 58, a magnificent statement of the disciples of the prophet Isaiah, which captures the very essence of their image of who God is. It reads like this. Shout for all you are worth, raise your voice like a trumpet. Proclaim their faults to my people, their sins to the house of Jacob. They seek me day after day. They long to know my ways, like a nation that wants to act with integrity and not ignore the law of its God. They ask me for laws that are just, and they long for God to draw near. Why should we fast, they say, if you never see it? Why do penance if you never notice? I hope you can associate with that prayer. It's a very common one. So the people are doing all the right things religiously. They're going to Mass on Sunday, or they're sending their kids to the right schools, if whatever that means. They're doing penance on penance days. They're fasting on they're doing all the right things, but something isn't happening in their lives. God doesn't seem to be noticing. They're not actually being invited into a religious experience through it all, and they're wondering why. And they're beautifully crying out to God for an answer, and unexpectedly God gives it, and just listen to it. Some of it applies, some of it doesn't, but listen. Look, says God, you do business on your fast days, you oppress your workmen, you quarrel and squabble when you fast, you strike the poor man with your fist. Fasting like yours today will never make your voice heard on high. Is that the sort of fast that pleases me? A truly penitential day for men? Hanging your head like a reed, lying down on sackcloth and ashes? Is that what you call fasting? A day acceptable to Yahweh? Isn't this the sort of fast that pleases me? It is the Lord Yahweh who speaks. To break unjust fetters, to undo the thongs of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free and break every yoke, to share your bread with the hungry and shelter the homeless poor, to clothe the man that you see to be naked and not turn from your own kin. Then will your light shine like the dawn and your wound be quickly healed. Then will your integrity go before you and the glory of Yahweh behind you. Cry then, and Yahweh will answer. Call, and he'll say, I'm here. If you do away with the yoke, the clenched fist, the wicked word, if you give your bread to the hungry and relief to the oppressed, your light will rise in the darkness, and your shadows become like noon. Yahweh will always guide you, giving you relief in desert places. He will give strength to your bones, and you shall be like a watered garden, like a spring of water whose waters never run dry. And so, to conclude the first part of our lecture tonight, when Jesus was a little boy, that was the God presented to him. Amid all the other mixed ideas, broken images, contradictory images that he was getting from the preaching, at the heart of his Jewish faith, like a burning in the coal there in the center of the hearth of their faith, was this burning bush, was this historical memory of a redemption that happened, that actually happened in history, and it really happened to real people. And the constant prophetic reiteration of the fact that whatever images they have of God, like a God who wants them to do fasting, fine, if it fits in somewhere, but it's not at the center. Like a God who talks about war and that, very dicey stuff. Somewhere here in the center there's something else, and it's not about that. It's about breaking yokes, it's about caring for the oppressed, it's about I am determined to set my people free. And the my people, as they become monotheist, becomes a whole world people, becomes a universal awareness of what the one Abba God wills for the world. Even if that's all we did, Jesus becomes really, everything he does becomes inevitable, really, almost. When you see him dreaming of and being taken into the mystery of that only living God of the Jewish faith.